But what's interesting, you're based in D.C. I think you said you live in Virginia. It's on your bio. Mm-hmm. But you're from Texas. And when you told me where you're from in Texas, I want you to quiz Wheeler on this.
Okay. I didn't know this was coming.
Tell him where you're from in Texas and see if he can identify where it is on the map.
Oh, you will be able to. It's Pampa, Texas. Everybody knows where Pampa, Texas is.
Pampa's down in the valley.
That's what I said.
That is incorrect.
You're about 1,000 miles away, my friend.
Where is Pampa? Is it Panhandle?
Pampa is in the Panhandle of Texas.
Okay.
So,
that's exactly what I said.
That's terrible.
Is it South Texas?
Some wonderful Texans up there.
I think that's the first time I've ever gotten one wrong.
Like, really?
I'm really good with Texas geography.
Lindsay, don't let him fool you. It's not.
Y'all, this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of Y'allitics. We are in the studio for this, very buttoned up. Wheeler has a collared shirt on, so you can tell how formal this is going to be. Now, I like to think that
I'm surprised you didn't mention that I'm in jeans, though.
Yeah, well, you're always in jeans. I mean,
yeah, it's the TV. So passe now.
But, you know, I like to think that I'm financially savvy. Not as much as you, obviously. I know you're going to take the throne on that.
Please. You're going to retire like a decade before I do.
I think I'm going to learn something from this podcast.
Oh, we are definitely going to learn a lot from this podcast. I'm very interested in what we're talking about today and who we're talking to today, because there's a lot that's going on. And I think that most of us just don't really... You know, we didn't have that education. We didn't have that class in school where we learned everything that we needed to know about finance and how it all works and what's coming and all of that. And so today we have an expert on to help us through that.
We have with us today Lindsay Johnson. She is the president of the Consumer Bankers Association trade group that represents the big banks in the U.S. More than 100 years old. Wow, you guys have been around for a moment here, too.
We have.
But what's interesting, you're based in D.C. I think you said you live in Virginia. It's on your bio. Mm-hmm. But you're from Texas. And when you told me where you're from in Texas, I want you to quiz Wheeler on this.
Okay. I didn't know this was coming.
Tell him where you're from in Texas and see if he can identify where it is on the map.
Oh, you will be able to. It's Pampa, Texas. Everybody knows where
Pampa's
Pampa, Texas is.
Pampa's down in the valley.
That's what I said.
That is
incorrect.
You're
about 1,000 miles away, my friend.
Where is Pampa? Is it Panhandle?
Pampa is in the Panhandle of Texas.
Okay.
So,
that's exactly what I said.
That's terrible.
Some wonderful Texans up there.
I think that's the first time I've ever gotten one wrong.
Like, really?
I'm really good with Texas geography.
Lindsay, don't let him fool you. It's not.
It's a big state.
It is a big state. So you grew up there?
Grew up in Pampa, Texas. It's 60 miles north of Amarillo.
Okay.
And hopefully people know where Amarillo is.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, just great people, a lot of oil, a lot of cattle, all the
things. That's what's in the panhandle.
Texas, great. That's
some cotton
right.
up there, too.
That's correct, yes.
Is that Potter County? Where is that?
It's Gray County, Randall County, Potter is all very close. Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
And you also spent some time here in North Texas.
I did. Yeah. I spent a couple of years at school here in the Dallas area. And I was just commenting before we walked in, it's fun every time I come back to this area, how much growth and just incredible things that you all are doing downtown, mm-hmm. as well as just kind of in the expanding areas, and it is expanding in every way. So it's a lot of fun to see it.
The sprawl is real. So, and we'll get into some of that growth too, because there's a story to be told there, and it ties directly into, you know, what is in your wheelhouse. But what brings you here this time?
So I'm speaking tomorrow to a group of bankers who are all women and really talking about women leadership and in particular in our industry and the importance of it. And we're doing some really good work in that area. And, you know, CBA has a focus on just making sure that we are really training up the next generation of diverse leaders to lead our industry. And so we've got some great stats that we can kind of point to. We've got an executive banking school that we host in South Carolina every year. Mm. And it's pretty much 50-50 men and women.
It's not as male-heavy as what a lot of people might think. I thought it was, you know, very male-dominated. Not really the case anymore.
There's been a lot of work, intentional work, to just make it, you know, represent all of us. And so it's a great testament to the industry.
Yeah. Let's start with all the news about the rate cut, because people are seeing this, the 25 percentage points.
Basis points.
What does this mean to the average person, Lindsay, to my mortgage, to my credit card bill, to my car loan? How does this impact me?
Well, I think, look, overall, it was largely kind of baked in, right? The market's been anticipating it. In fact, we were talking about on the way over, like, I didn't see a ton of news, and I'm sure that there will be, but I think the market's largely anticipated this. They've been projecting it for quite some time. We anticipate that there might be another one, but before the end of the year. And I think ultimately, you know, consumers have been dealing with really, you know, some interesting, we'll call it that, times over the last 6 years. And so we've seen inflation really tick up over the last 4 years. Obviously, the Fed's trying to deal with that, trying to manage kind of through a very interesting cycle coming out of COVID. And they're clearly projecting here that the work's not done. So labor is maybe, you know, a little bit weaker around the edges, not in all parts of the country. I definitely don't think that that's the case here in Texas, but in some parts of the country, you know, and so they're monitoring that, and we'll see if they lead with another cut.
But since the market had this, the stock market had this priced in, baked in, if you will, what does it mean to for folks who are just, you know, may not play the stock market every day, may have a 401k that they just dump money into and forget about? Will it impact mortgage rates? Will it impact car loans?
Eventually,
like
it will. Yes, eventually it will. It's going to bleed through, obviously, the 10-year and, you know, some of these other rates that people really start to feel. They're going to start to feel those in their mortgage rates, for example. And when you have mortgage rates that are 7% for a prolonged period of time, you know, again, all of us can remember a time when mortgage rates were 18%, or our parents can remember that, right? But it's been a long time for consumers to see rates go up to 7% for a mortgage rate. And so you're going to see potentially a lot of refinances. It has a lot of implications in the mortgage market and the auto lending market. So it does have material impacts on consumers' pocketbooks.
That mortgage rate's been stair-stepping down through through much of the year now, and we have seen already this rush to refinance. You know,
at 6%.
Right. Some people not waiting, like, might it go down further? They're like, hey, I'm going to cash in on this right now, and if I need to do another one, you know, a year from now, I'll do it a year from now. Can we talk about this Fed interest rate cut, though, and how, you know, a lot of people, I think, are more aware of it this time because it became very political. It's been in the news, and it's been very political. What is your thought about that? Because I know that that has been a concern to some, that this has gotten wrapped into politics and Fed governors by name are being called out, you know, leading up to this. What's your thought about that?
Well, honestly, I don't have a whole lot of thoughts about it. I mean, you know, obviously we've got people who are going to speak their mind and give their views. And I don't think it's necessarily swayed the Fed in one way or another. I think you've heard a lot of banks come out and say, we want an independent Fed. We want a Fed who can really base their judgments and their decisions on data, which is crucially important to everyone. And so, you know, ultimately, hopefully we kind of continue to land in that direction, that path. Notwithstanding, there are a lot of questions, and I think that there's going to be some scrutiny about, you know, different players at on the Federal Reserve Board. And we'll see, again, probably Congress asking some questions, and you're already seeing that. And that'll just kind of play into the political dynamics in D.C. Ultimately, hopefully, it results in continue to be an independent Fed, but also a Fed that, you know, is above board and everybody trusts, right? We want to make sure that they're is a great source of trust within the Federal Reserve and the people who are there. So politics are going to be politics. People are going to ask questions, and we'll see how this plays out long
term. How much is the industry watching it, though, when we see things like one of the Fed governors in particular, the president tried to remove her. That's the first time that's happened since the Fed was created back in, I think it was 1913. An appeals court overruled that. She was still, you know, in the meeting this time around. Are bankers talking about that kind of stuff, though? Do they watch that kind of stuff closely? I know that that's been alarming to some, but do they pay close attention to that?
Personally, I'm sure all of them are paying attention to it, but we're not really having a lot of conversations, and partly because, as you said, it's being challenged in court. They're going to fight it out in court, and so thankfully, we've got a system here in the United States where we've got a system where, you know, we've got an executive branch and they can challenge different things. And then we've got a court system that's going to weigh whether that is appropriate or not. And they're going to make decisions. So we don't have a lot of conversations around this. We do talk about what's happening in the broader economy and, you know, some of the things that are happening in the Fed rate and the rate cut today plays largely into much of that. So everyone's paying attention a lot to those items. Not as much to the politics.
Is there anxiety around the politics, though, at all, Lindsay?
Because it seems, I think, you know,
is there?
geopolitical swings, I would say, more generally. And this has been true, you know, for a couple of decades now, and you all talk about it all the time. But the massive shifts in political swings every 4 years or so has become so polarizing for the country in general, but also for our industry. And we've seen politics seep into regulatory agencies, for example. And, you know, in the last administration, one of the industry or one of the agencies that we pay a lot of attention to is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We believe in the CFPB. We think that there is a purpose for the CFPB. But it had gotten so political that it was hard to even kind of parse out for consumers, for, you know, policymakers, what was fact and what was fiction, because so much of it was political campaigning, and ultimately it was going to leave consumers worse off. And so we've, you know, again, the banking industry is not always the voice that gets out there. They're very conservative. They want to make sure that they're, you know, just sticking to their knitting. And yet we were stepping up and saying, that is not fact, and we're going to push back on it because ultimately it hurts consumers. So that's what we pay a lot of attention to, is when that polarization and when those politics start to seep into agencies that shouldn't be political.
Well, let me ask you about the CFPB. You testified before Congress about this not too long ago, and you expressed concern, and you kind of repeated some of the lines here that every administration kind of does things vastly different, and you need some stability, it sounds like, in your voice here, that, you know, our industry needs that stability. The Trump administration's trying to reimagine government, and the CFPB was right in the crosshairs. So if this thing goes away, how does that leave me exposed as a consumer? How does that impact banking?
Well, let me kind of pull it back. There's a few different layers. So one, the banking industry is one of, if not the most highly regulated industries in the world. So not only do you have consumer protection from the CFPB, and the CFPB was really created coming out of Dodd-Frank to really put all the consumer protections from the other agencies into one agency. But the other agencies, the OCC, the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, even states, still play a role in consumer protection. And so banks get, you know, a lot of regulation and a lot of consumer protection regulation. There's this whole other side of the system, the non-bank side, where CFPB really is the only regulator of those players. And so we've said for a long time, you need a CFPB because they were created to make sure that there's competition in the marketplace and the consumers can get their financial services products anywhere with the same protection. That's not quite where we are today.
Was that message received in D.C., do you think, when you were up there?
I testified and I got asked point blank, do you agree that there should be a CFPB? And my response was yes.
Well, there is still one. Work has stopped there. Yeah. So is that... how does that endanger a consumer? How does it endanger the banking industry? Is there concern in the industry, I guess, that, you know, if that remains that way, that the pendulum swings even further the next time there's a political change?
So I would say this. It had gotten so political that they were campaigning. They were basically polling on different messages. For example, junk fees. And they would go out and they said, oh my gosh, that pulls so well. And so we're going to fill all these buckets of junk fees, overdraft, credit card late fees. And they would talk about it and they would kind of skip the legally required rulemaking process to jump ahead and to say things and to do things that they knew were going to be politically popular.
This was during the Biden administration.
During the Biden administration.
Sure. And so they reduced some of those fees, which have now been rolled back.
So I'll give you an example, though. So they would, on overdraft, for example, right? I mean, I understand that no one wants to pay a fee if you've overdrafted your account, but it's a service that banks offer to their consumers. And according to the Fed, 80% of consumers knew that they were going to incur that fee. They choose to incur that fee. You opt in to have overdraft service. As a young 20-something-year-old person living in D.C., I can tell you I benefited greatly from overdraft service. The thing that the CFPB would do, though, is to justify their actions. They would actually use false data and inaccurate information. So they release this survey about making ends meet, and they talk about overdraft and that these consumers have other options and access to credit. It simply wasn't true. They excluded 26 million Americans who don't have access to credit, to credit-invisible individuals. Those are the individuals who will no longer have access to those products and services and really would start to have diminished access to the well-regulated banking system. They don't talk about that. They don't. Credit card late fees is another one where the vast majority of consumers say, yeah, you should pay your credit card on time. And it might sound great to lower a fee if you pay late from $30 or $35 to $8, but that changes entirely a bank's ability to manage that risk. It changes the incentive behavior for a consumer to pay on time, because now, you know, I can buy the $300 pair of shoes, but it's only going to cost me a cup of coffee, basically, to pay late.
They did. There was one case, just pulled one out, where they fined a big bank a couple of years ago for allegedly putting multiple insufficient fund fees on a single transaction, withholding promised credit card account bonuses, such as cash rewards or bonus points, and illegally applying for and enrolling consumers in credit card accounts without the consumer's knowledge or authorization, illegally using or obtaining their credit reports without their permission to complete applications. When you, and you, I'm sure, are familiar with the case that I'm talking about there, but generally, when you see and hear those sorts of things, I'm curious what the view is from your perch.
So there's a couple of different things. One, if a bank has done something illegal or wrong, they should be fined, and they should be punished, right? The challenge has been that oftentimes these things that the CFPB would come at a bank for, and they would apply a UDAP violation, but they would do it at their discretion. So it was something that was completely legal, and there was even agency guidance on it previously, that they would now say, today is illegal, and I'm going to fine you every day that you were doing it before. It's like changing the speed limit and telling, you know, drivers that every day that you drove the previous speed limit, I'm going to fine you. And then they would come out with this salacious headline. They did. That was one of, again, one of the ways that they were weaponizing government. There would be, and there was a non-bank, they got fined. They named investors in that fintech company who had nothing to do with the violation, just named them in 18-point font, because it was a name and shame kind of game. And, you know, maybe they were of one political affiliation or not, but that is inappropriate no matter who it is. So whether it was a bank, whether it was a non-bank, whatever the issue was, we want the CFPB to be credible and to be durable so that they have a future actually regulating and doing the best thing for consumers.
But you'd actually like to see them back to work again.
So, and actually, I will say, they are back to work. They're working
really
very hard. They just released, they put out these agendas every couple of, about every 6 months. And they just put out their spring or their fall regulatory agenda. Hmm. It was the most fulsome we've ever seen. So they are really vigorously at work. They are, you know, probably a leaner team than they were before, but they still have a lot of the team that was there previously under the Biden administration and even previous administrations are still there, and they're still working. And so I don't have all the details in terms of what their plans are, but I can tell you that their regulatory agenda is quite robust. And they've issued some enforcement actions.
Was there anything in it that made you think, oh, we've got to fight this, or we may have a problem with that, or that's going to be a lot of work on banks?
We're going to have a lot of conversations with them.
That's the nice way of answering that. I like that.
I've been in D.C. for a while now. I'm getting a little politique. But we're going to have some conversations. One of the things that we want to see is, again, whether you're getting so more consumers have fintech apps on their phone than they've got, you know, streaming services, for example. Mm-hmm. Like it's proliferated. It's not just banks. It's fintechs and non-banks and others. One of the things we want to see is, as we move forward, it's going to be even more important because more players are coming into the marketplace. Whether you get it at a fintech or a bank, that consumer has no idea what protection they're getting. They just assume it's all the same, and it should be. So if it's a like activity, it should be the same regulation, and consumers shouldn't have to wonder if they're going to be protected or not.
Security protections, or what are you talking about for these protections?
So data and privacy protections, yeah. Yes, absolutely. And banks are held to the highest standard.
Sure.
But any other kind of consumer protection, so all the things that a bank has to adhere to, supervision, examination from the CFPB and from other regulators, you know, other entities will have to adhere to it too. We can have a lot of debate, and it's healthy too, about the right level of regulation. Mm. The costs, if they outweigh the benefits, we should be able to talk about it. And you'll hear everybody from Jamie Dimon to the smallest bank CEOs talk about that cost. But we at least should be playing at the same level.
Everything is changing.
What's Jamie Dimon like, though, out of curiosity? Have you met Jamie?
So I have met him in a larger function.
Yeah.
I will tell you, I work with the consumer retail head, so usually the CEOs of some of the mid-sized banks and then the CEOs of the consumer banks. They're awesome. And many of them are
Jamie seems like
jeans
a good guy.
And he is wicked smart. Yeah. I mean, there is not a person in this world that will not tell you he's wicked smart.
You have
and he's
to be in that job.
In a good heart. I mean, you talk to any of our bankers, and of course there's going to be bad apples. And again, if somebody breaks the law, they should go after them. But the vast majority of our folks, we got 2 million people across the country, 75,000 plus in Texas alone, who wake up every day and say, I want to compete vigorously and I want to serve consumers. And so how do we do that better?
Let's talk about, and this kind of gets into that headcount that you're talking about, because I asked AI, put the question out there, if AI is going to be a good or bad thing for banking in the years to come. It was a mixed bag. On the good side, it says efficiency, increased efficiencies with AI are going to save banks about $1 trillion by 2030. That seems like a lot, but maybe. It said that there will be enhanced customer experiences, better fraud detection, better cybersecurity, and faster decision making for loans and investment strategies. So those are the good things that AI sees AI bringing to banking. The
I feel
bad
like it's
things,
got a bias.
AI is promoting itself here, right?
The bad things, though, it says it might amplify biases and lead to unfair lending decisions or discriminatory outcomes. That it might also create new cybersecurity vulnerabilities and job displacement. Your industry, like many industries, is going through a sea change right now with AI. What do you see in the years ahead? Because banking is changing.
It is changing rapidly. It's one of the most exciting times to be in the industry right now. I mean, think about, you know, the promise of having an AI agent in your pocket that can help you understand financial situations, decisions that you may not even understood were present to you.
So
and
what can
it
do for me?
You.
Like, can I ask it, you know, like, hey, you know.
Today, you can ask Erica, which is a Bank of America, on their app.
Yeah.
it can understand pretty much, you know, any complex question you've got on the financial side about your account, about some of your financial decisions. It can really help guide you. One, on the efficiency side, it completely helps make things more efficient, puts information right to the consumer's fingertips so that they can really start to understand on their own and control their financial services, you know, to the maximum extent possible. But when we think about the future, and, you know, one of the things that we talk about right now, and it's very cutting edge, is agentic AI. And so where agents and bots are talking to each other, even outside of financial services. So think about if I'm trying to buy a red shirt online, and I have said as a consumer, I want to buy a red shirt, go out and find it for me. And there's an agent that goes and does that. And then there's another agent that is kind of negotiating the price. And ultimately, could that agent purchase things? All kinds of implications for the financial services industry. So we're thinking, you know, years ahead. I honestly think that technology is going to be here very soon. And how does that change a consumer's behavior? How do we adapt our own technologies to withstand some of the fraud that could happen? And AI is a great example, because one of the biggest issues that we've seen, particularly through COVID, is fraud and scams. And consumers getting scammed out of their own money.
Huge.
We are using AI. That's the number one, one of the number one reasons that AI, that banks implement AI, is for fraud detection. And it's incredible what it can do. Well, it also has the potential, as you mentioned, to maybe create other vectors of fraud, right? It's going to be harder to detect those bots and those agents. So we are thinking about those things every day. We are working with our members to really kind of think through long term, how do we start to combat those things? But also, how do we position ourselves to be part of the consumer's financial lives long term and adapt to those changing preferences and how they're going to shop in the future?
Because for us, banking is going to look very different, let's say, 3-5 years from now, isn't it?
Yes. I think that there's always going to be that person you want to speak to, right? There's always going to be the demand. And I think about even myself, the last time I've gone into a branch. But when I have a complex question, I want to walk in, I want to talk to somebody. I want someone who knows me, knows my financial history, knows what I'm trying to achieve, and can give me a little bit of guidance along the way. And so there will always be that need for the human, as well as the digital transformation that we've seen.
If we can just teach AI, though, to put me through to the representative when I really scream representative, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Can we
and
work
I will
on
say
that?
Banks are actually doing really good on that front, but there are some other industries where, you know, there's been so much research in this space. One of the things that consumers get most frustrated about is if they're working with AI and they're saying, okay, I'm willing to do this, and then I get transferred to an agent and they don't know anything
about it. Start over.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
a lot of things we can learn.
I'm a Bank of America customer, and Erica is great only to a point, though. And then I need a real person. But
and
no,
then you want a person.
Absolutely. You know, the other big news here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area is Y'all Street.
Yes.
Wall Street coming to Texas. Big banks coming down here. The Texas Stock Exchange.
The New York Stock Exchange also, you know, setting up shop here, too.
You know, Texans love to brag. How big of a deal is this, though, on the outside? I mean, how big of a deal is it?
Huge. Everything's big in Texas, and that is truly not an overstatement. Whether it is, you know, obviously you all have the greatest number of banks generally in the country. So there is a bank on every corner, and you've got the most number of community banks. My mom was a community banker. I love community banks.
Wow, you kept it in the family.
Yeah, really good.
I love community banks. But we also see some of the big players, to your point, the Wall Street folks coming in because they see all the economic activity that's happening in this part of the country, and some of those mid-sized players. So Fifth Third and Regions and a number of other players are expanding their footprints, in addition to companies like JP who have been here for 100 years, but they've got a technology hub. I don't know if you've seen it. It is incredible. You know, they've got around 18,000 people employed in the state of Texas, actually locally here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, just doing amazing things. But it's because they've been part of this economic growth and they see more potential coming. So they're continuing to kind of expand that that footprint.
Are bankers in D.C. and New York, are they like really aware of what's happening here? Are they talking about this? Is this something that's beyond Texas?
Are they really?
Every single bank is talking about the Southeast, and Texas is sort of the epicenter for a lot of that activity. I mean, there's just, and you all know it, you've lived it, you've seen it, particularly over the last 10 years and particularly over the last 5 years, there's just been this continued momentum here in the South, and in Texas in particular, bringing new economies in, you know, from technology and, you know, manufacturing jobs. I mean, it's really incredible to see everything that's happening in this part of the country. And you see a lot of that being driven by banks coming in and investing and also attracting a talent pool here that you've got in Texas.
Okay, and that makes me ask this. I need you to settle this for us and pick a side.
Yes.
You know, keep seeing headlines about the number of financial services jobs that have been created here and these notions that the Dallas-Fort Worth area is now already the banking center of the country. It is the biggest banking center. Has it overtaken New York in that?
Or Charlotte? You know, Charlotte liked to brag about that.
You know, I cannot say definitively. This is a thing I'll have to go and study.
You have been in D.C. too long.
You're an East Coaster. I truly do not know the answer, but I do know that it's grown exponentially. Probably the fastest of any region, for sure, is right here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Okay, we'll take that. That partially settles it.
You're on the Hill a lot, Lindsay, and there's sometimes a feeling that, you know, what happens in D.C. doesn't really trickle down and affect me. It's more of a team sport in D.C., and which team do you line up with the letter behind your name? But can you give us any real world examples of how legislation or regulation has actually impacted Texans?
Absolutely. There are actually so many ways that, you know, the things that are happening in D.C., it's why it's important for our bankers, the people, even the tellers and, you know, the local folks that you work with on the ground to tell their story, because they see the consumers walking in and they understand sort of what's happening on the ground. Overdraft was a great example where the minute that we started to explain to people what was going to happen and who was going to get hurt, you know, Congress understood that and they actually went and did something that's fairly unique and rare. They actually did a Congressional Review Act, which means not only can the agency, it kind of killed the rule that was final, they can't write a substantially similar rule in the future. So Congress really spoke and kind of joined together and said, that's not good for the consumer. That's going to hurt a lot of people and push them to title loans and pawn and other things. So it has very real world implications, whether it's at the agency or within Congress. Congress just passed, I'm sure you all have heard of the One Big Beautiful Bill.
I haven't heard of that.
And so, never heard of that, right?
No.
One Big Beautiful Bill. A lot of things in there. And, you know, some of those things are around student lending. And really, you know, I think the administration in Congress was trying to get its arms around what is a pretty tenuous situation right now. You know, 90% plus of outstanding student loans are done through the federal government. We've never had as high of a delinquency rate as we have right now. And part of that was because we paused payments, mm-hmm. and now folks are coming back into repayment. This has real world implications for a lot of consumers. Mm. And so how do we think about that long term? How do we put better options on the table that protect taxpayers, that create a lot of the right incentives for schools and universities to control costs and to help students, and to make sure that when students graduate, that they're going to be able to afford the loan that they've taken out. There's very little financial literacy for a student. You don't get, when you actually borrow from the federal government, you don't get statements, simple statements to say, this is how much you borrowed to date. We need to do a better job as a country of educating students when they're in school, as they're taking out these loans, that they're going to have to repay it at the end of this, at the end of their school journey, and what that looks like, what that means for them. How can they think about, you know, what kind of job it's going to be able to afford that kind of payment? So there's a lot of work to be done.
Several years ago, we had a series here at the television station where we work called Banking Under 30, Banking Below 30.
Yeah.
And it looked at disparities above and below I-30 as far as investment goes, and found that there was a big drop-off in investment in minority communities to the south of I-30 in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, a big drop-off in the number of banks that you could even access there compared to the north side. Does redlining still happen where minority communities are sort of cut out? Is that still happening, or is that something that is being worked on, has been worked on?
Huge emphasis for our industry, for banking industry. You know, I can't really speak to non-banks and to some of the others, and I hope that there's as much of an emphasis. Look, banks are required by law, obviously. We've got a lot of equal protection laws in place. Yeah. We also have CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act, that says we have to go in and make investments in different communities. Not only do we do that in those communities, but you also see our banks moving their geographies into those locations. Wells Fargo is actually going into Philadelphia and into different parts of Pennsylvania, which may not be one of the highest growing areas in the country, but there is a need there, and they want to make sure that they've got a presence and branches. You've got JP Morgan that's gone into Detroit and done an incredible amount of revitalization in Detroit.
Detroit's
Baltimore,
a heck of a story. Yeah.
Oh, it's an incredible story. Baltimore, same thing. So you see these banks, you know, going above and beyond sort of what the law requires in terms of equal access and equal and fair lending laws, and making sure that not only are they investing through CRA, but they're taking their businesses in those locations and making sure that they're building out a presence in the community, which is phenomenal.
Is it still a work in progress, what you say?
So look, 96% of consumers are in the banking system. That is a tremendous stride forward. Things like overdraft, things like free access to free banking accounts, access to bank on accounts, which have no fees. I mean, the industry has worked very hard over the last couple of decades to get to that number. And so, yes, there's always more work to be done, but I would say we're making incredible strides, and we've got to continue to innovate to really meet people where they are. And sometimes that's in their hands.
You were kind enough to give us a half hour. Let me ask you my last question here too. It's in this hyper partisan environment we are in, we've seen big tech get political. It seems like big banking has been able to avoid that. How has that happened, and will you be able to continue that in the future?
Look, I mean, I think one of the things that we talk about within CBA, and we've got 75 members that range from $10 billion in assets, which is really a community bank, all the way up to the biggest, we stick to our knitting, and we understand, I mean, boring banking is okay. Boring in the way that, you know, we go out and we serve our customers and we are on the ground with them. We are understanding their needs. Not boring in any other way. Mm. So innovating, being proactive, thinking about AI, not being threatened by it, not being threatened by other players, really welcoming the competition, embracing it. If they have a better mousetrap, we're going to buy it or build it or do it better. And so, look, I think that...
But you still have to navigate the regulations of D.C. And make sure that...
And states.
And states also. I mean, are you concerned that things are getting too political?
Yes. I mean, it is something. And it was interesting because in the hearing where I testified in July, one of the things I heard from both sides was a recognition that we don't want politics in our agencies in particular. And so, again, you know, come down the middle of the line, you know, call balls and strikes as you see fit. We shouldn't be measuring the success of one of these agencies in terms of the penalties that they levy on the industry, because that was one of their talking points, is we've got $20 billion from the industry. Well, that says a lot about that regulator as well, right? There were the rules of the road not clear enough? What were those levies? Why were they imposed? Were they for something retroactive that was completely legal? There are a lot of questions. We would never judge a referee based on the outcome of the game, right? And we really want him.
We do that all the time.
Well, we hopefully do not do that at the agency level.
Yeah.
We really want to understand, was the game fair?
Sure.
And that's where we really want to get in banking.
Being in the banking industry, I'm sure that you are a great counter, and you probably, like I did, counted three questions for that last question from Whiteley.
So the last topic.
He's very good.
It was the last topic.
I will say this, as far as building better mousetraps, as you said, some banks even now, looking at, or maybe even have already done it, creating their own tokens because cryptocurrency is such a thing. Mm-hmm. Things are changing for sure. My true last question for you, and it's only one, is we've had recently the highest number of long-term unemployment claims since the pandemic. And again, that's, in different parts of the country, it looks different.
Yeah.
Record student loan and credit card debt. Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about that. Inflation still stubbornly above where the Fed wants it to be. Can't quite, smash it down. We've got, tariffs, et cetera. What are you seeing right now? What is your industry seeing with the average American, and what are you looking for as we go forward? Because it feels like we're sort of at this, fork in the road where things could go one way or they could go very much another way. What are you looking for? What should we be looking for?
I think that two
questions.
It's all in one question, though.
I think that we watch a lot of those things that you just said. So consumers are still, even though there's record high levels of credit card debt, a few things, and you have to unpack it, but there's more people that have credit cards, which is a good thing, mm-hmm. access to credit.
Yeah.
Prices have been elevated over the last several years, and so that's another reason balances are higher, but they're paying down faster. Student lending, obviously people are coming into repayment. It means a lot for them to assume this payment when they've got other payments happening. One thing that we watch, for example, is how high car prices had gotten, the average car price, and looking at the number of people that are buying those new cars at that average car price, it's in the $700 range, and who have credit card debt as well. But again, consumers have shown incredible resilience through mm-hmm. this, and they continue to pay down at a faster rate. And so on the consumer side, the strength is still there. They're still showing really good liquidity. But on the broader scale, there is some reason that, everybody needs to be watching more on the macro level, paying attention to the labor market and the softening around the edges, understanding when students are graduating, that's one of the cohorts that actually seems to be kind of impacted by the labor market right now.
Mm-hmm.
So really watching all these things and making sure that we are adjusting and thinking about credit standards and other things like that as an industry to do our part and make sure that we're lending in the right areas, but also supporting consumers, as they're kind of navigating this next phase of the economy.
Mm-hmm. And it will be a next phase indeed. I mean, let's fingers crossed we get through it.
Yeah.
Boy, that's a bright outlook as we close the podcast.
I'm watching the Fed here like the rest of us.
I'm optimistic.
Yeah, you sound very optimistic. Yeah. I was just thinking that in your final comment there. Lindsay, great insight. Thank you so much. And I hope you let me ask you this. So you have this speaking
it's
engagement
a fourth
tomorrow.
Question. Here we are.
Where are you going for dinner tonight? Where's the barbecue you're going for tonight? Have you been told to go to any certain place?
I have not been told. If you have a secret recommendation, do not hide out.
We'll
they've got
out.
A sponsored podcast, or we're not doing
that's
it.
Right.
We'll give you some information off air.
Off air. There you go. Okay.
Lindsay Johnson's the president and CEO of Consumer Bankers Association. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
This was excellent.